When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everybody, welcome to Literary Disco and Lit Hub Radio, episode 197, East of Eden. Today, we take on John Steinbeck's classic, epic novel, East of Eden, which centers on the Salinas Valley of California and tells the story of several generations of the Trask and Hamilton families. This is Literary Disco, the last book club you'll ever need. We are Todd, Julia, and Ryder, three old friends who love to read, debate, and sometimes even agree. I am actor and filmmaker Ryder Strong. Joining me, as always, are novelist and critic Todd Goldberg and essayist and radio personality Julia Pistel. Hi, guys.
Hey!
Hello. I'm back.
Ryder is back. Ryder has been on an epic road trip. The last time... Well, Julia just saw Ryder, but the last time Ryder was home was, what, 5 weeks ago?
4 weeks ago. Yeah, July 1st we left, and we're recording this on the 27th.
So. Oh, my God. So yeah. You might go there, and there might be squatters living in your house.
Well, I have friends staying at my house, so yes, they just might refuse to leave.
So where in the world have you been?
Everywhere. So we started in Northern California, where I grew up, for 4th of July on my parents' property, camping out there. Then we went to the Eastern Sierras, which was wonderful. And we camped there for a while, like four nights in the Eastern Sierras, which I had never been to. I grew up exploring the Western Sierras, but I'd never been to the Eastern Sierras. And it was gorgeous and amazing. And we had a bear encounter, which was awesome and so thrilling for my son, Indy, to, you know, be terrified of a bear.
To face death. To stare into the eyes of a...
Well, it was the worst because we actually watched it. It came into our camp. We had two bear encounters in the same day, broad daylight. The first one I missed. And the second one, we were literally carrying back the box because we had left the box in our car that's labeled survival, which includes the bear spray and the air horn that you're supposed to use to scare bears. So when we So after the first bear encounter, we were like, oh, we should probably get the survival box. We're like, okay. So we were carrying the cooler between me and my wife with Indy trailing behind it. We had the cooler between us and the survival box on top of it. And our friends who we were camping with started screaming from the campsite, it's in our campsite. So I, you know, drop everything, grab the air horn and like go over there, and they've scrambled up onto a boulder. So I joined them on the boulder, and we just watched this bear go through our garbage that we had left out. We had like one of these little portable, so stupid to leave our garbage out. And then, you know, once it ate the applesauce that was in there, and I'm sitting there blowing the air horn out of trying to scare it away, and it just doesn't care, you know. Bears don't give a fuck. And then it just went into the next campsite, and this is the horrifying part. We just watched it with one hand just like claw open the tent. Like, just go like whoomp, and rip open the tent because the people in the campsite next to us had left soap in one of their bags. So it was like so easy. It was like exactly what you fantasize or you like have nightmares about at night, right? Is that a bear is just going to like rip into your tent so easily. That's exactly what I was like. Ugh. Anyway, I find it exciting. It kind of kept us on our edge, and we slept there that night, and it was fine. And I'm glad, you know, now my son has like a bear encounter, you know. Already, it was like only day two of our trip. Aww. So,
and like, what do you do after that? Like, well, let's find a puma, let it chase Indy around.
Yeah, no, I think you know it's good to toughen him up. Like he's been bragging about it everywhere we go. It's like, you know, I had a bear encounter, and it was awesome. And then we headed into the Southwest. We had a night in Vegas when it was 110 degrees. Went to the Zion Bryce area and went hiking around there.
Beautiful.
Which is gorgeous. Yeah. And then we went into Colorado. We had a friend who was managing a hotel in Colorado for the summer, and that was gorgeous. Silverton, Colorado. It was amazing. We went whitewater rafting. We did some dune bugging. And then we're just like, since we left the West, it was mostly about seeing people, like friends. And you know, once you get past Kansas, like everything's a lot closer together. So we were able to like just see friends, like, one after another, including Julia up in Connecticut, which was awesome. We got to walk around and put her daughter on my one wheel.
Yeah, there was a lot of risk-taking.
little life-threatening one-wheel experience. Yeah, man, it's been a blast. And now we're on our way back. We're in Atlanta right now at a lake. Our friends have a lake house outside of Atlanta, so we're here. And my son got to jet ski today for the first time.
It's been
a very adventurous summer, and, like, you know, luckily Indy's sick, so he'll actually remember this, I think. And, you know, it's the summer vacation. But, I mean, I feel like I talked about this trip on the show when I was first dreaming about it last fall. I feel like I was like, you know what I'm going to do? A road trip. And I'm just like, we're doing it, you know? And it's been hard. Like, it's been really tough. Like, you know, our son drives us crazy. We drive him crazy. My wife's been producing a film this entire time, so she's, like, been literally doing Zoom meetings. I released the music video while we were here, so I was doing interviews with magazines and promoting on social media. So, like, a lot. It's just been a lot. Like, you know, and if you ask my wife, like, it's probably too much. But I am just so happy that we did it, you know.
You're, like, going to look back on it. This is something that you'll keep forever.
And
it's just exhausting.
I can't imagine that Ryder would have over-programmed a vacation.
Ridiculous.
That doesn't seem like something. That's not the Ryder strong. I
actually don't understand how you did all that, because now you're in Atlanta. You saw me a few days ago.
Yeah.
I don't understand. I need a map with timelines another time, because it's crazy.
We've been driving. I mean, like, yeah, we've been driving a lot, you know, but it's exhausting. But luckily, I've had some light beach reading.
You chose this.
John Steinbeck's East of Eden.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, my God.
We could have done Grapes of Wrath. You're bringing back so many memories for me. So I've gone cross-country twice, and one of the times I read Grapes of Wrath, which is a perfect cross-country book, but not this one.
No. And, you know, the thing about East of Eden, so the copy that I'm holding up is the copy that I have had, well, as long as I can remember owning books, I've had this copy of East of Eden.
Which is the same one I have that disintegrated.
Yeah.
I got the new one.
Yeah, like, this one's still, like, I must have bought this for high school or something like that, which is the first time I read it. But it's 700 pages long.
Why did we take, this is the first question I have for you guys, why did we take a leisurely 5 months to read an 800 page book, and then I read this thing in 5 days?
Well, so here's the difference. So East of Eden might be 700 pages long, but there's tons and tons of dialogue. Not great dialogue, but there's tons and tons of dialogue. Whereas Middlemarch, it's 800 pages describing furniture and fever hospitals.
So I'm just saying, there's a middle ground here.
Yeah, this is not a quick read by any stretch of the imagination. But you know what I also did, guys? So I reread it, and then I was like, I remember seeing the movie, I think. And I was like, no, I didn't see the movie. I actually watched the miniseries that came out in the 80s when I was a kid, that was like 8 nights, and Jane Seymour played the mom. Kate. Yeah. But this morning, I'd never seen it. I watched the East of Eden movie with James Dean in it.
Yeah, I've never seen it either. How was it?
It bears absolutely no resemblance to the book at all.
I kind of figured, because when I found out that James Dean played Cal, I was like, but Cal's only in the book for now I know he's actually in the book for a lot longer than I thought. But, like, Cal's sort of an after. I mean, he is kind of ends up being the hero. But I was like, he's also only, like, 15.
So the East of Eden movie that made James Dean, actually only encompasses literally the last three chapters of the book.
Whoa. Okay, that's what I figured. Yeah, that's so weird.
Okay.
And so when people think about East of Eden based on the film, they have no, they don't know anything about the BDSM. For instance,
I forgot all
that's
of that.
That's not in there?
By the way.
I'd forgotten a ton of stuff in this book.
Oh, wait, so was this a reread for all of us? Or Julia was? It was.
No, okay. I read this.
So we all read this before. Yeah. This is probably my third or fourth time reading this book, actually. Although I realized maybe I never finished it the third or fourth time, because I thought the book ended with Samuel's death. So when I realized that that happened and I still had 400 more pages, right. I was like, wow, there's a lot. Okay, there's a lot of going
yeah,
the
on. They're still in the East at that point.
Yes, exactly. But the first 300 or 400 pages I've read so many times because there are sentences that are like ingrained in my brain. And I don't know how much of that is just because it was like the first like important serious book I read when I was probably 13 or 14, I think is when I read this book in high school. Or if I've just read it so many times, either way, like it was crazy how familiar the first half of this
book
was.
So why don't you explain, because we have a lot to discuss. So we need a quickie on the plot. Yeah. Ryder, if you want to go for it.
Yeah, sure. So,
I'm going to go get groceries. And when you're done, just blow that air horn and I'll be back.
All right. Well, it starts with a family in the East and it's led by, well, actually, oh God. It starts with a description of the Salinas Valley.
Okay.
In Northern California.
Yes, it does. Okay. Well, I'm going to.
Okay. So basically, there's two families. There's the Hamiltons, which, it starts with the patriarch of the Hamiltons, which is Samuel Hamilton and his wife, Liza. And they have 9 children. And we get a very, like, sort of terse description of all 9 kids. And then it's also telling the story of the Trask family, which begins in the East Coast. And it's centered on Cyrus. And he's this wannabe war hero who makes up a war history for himself and becomes somebody very important. And his two sons,
Cain and Abel.
Adam and Charles.
Listeners,
all you need to know is everybody whose name starts with a C is bad.
And everyone whose name starts with an A is good.
Is angelic.
Yeah,
so basically it's a retelling of the Cain and Abel story.
Three times.
So the Trask family, is it three or is it just twice? Is it three? No, because Cyrus probably had a brother with a name that we don't know.
Right.
Alex.
Right. Right.
Okay. So they're, right, so the, eventually Adam lives a life of fighting the war and traveling the world as a hobo and being in jail. And this is all within the first 100 pages.
Yeah.
And Charles takes over the farm while his dad goes to Washington and becomes a decorated war commander of some sort. And Charles always wants his father's affection. Adam could care less, but always has his father's affection. It's a very heavy-handed Cain and Abel story. Charles gets marked by a stone. The mark of Cain, guys. It's on him. Adam comes back from his wanderings, and the two brothers live uneasily on the farm, and then eventually they save a woman. Kathy.
Right.
Who is literally the devil,
and
a demon woman, succubus.
And you are now, by the way, on page 300.
Not even.
And we haven't even gotten to Salinas. I mean, except for a couple chapters on the Hamilton family, which you're constantly wondering, why are we reading about them? We get their story a little bit. But finally, he marries
Kathy
against Charles' wishes. They get rich from their father. They get a bunch of money because their father dies, which happens twice in the book, too. People die and lots of money just comes in.
A lot of inheritances,
A little, Deus Ex Machina. And then...
and or beans.
And then Adam moves to Salinas with his two sons. Oh, because...
Twins.
He moves there with his wife first, without her being pregnant. And then she is pregnant. She doesn't want to go because she's evil.
She's
literally
so
explained
evil.
To
we're
be evil.
We're going to get back to her.
Yeah, we're going to talk a lot about
and,
Kathy.
But before that, she also has hooked up with Adam's brother,
Charles.
They have crazy monkey sex.
Right. And Adam is in love with Kathy, even though he's blind and doesn't see her for who she really is.
Right. He can't,
the devil.
He can't tell what any fucking moron could tell, which is that she's no good. She's a witchy woman.
And then Adam finally meets Sam Hamilton and hires a Chinese cook named Lee.
Oy vey.
The three of them
Lee.
Form the central friendship connection that ties a lot of the threads together in this book.
And
that's really the part that I remembered the most and like thought of the most because, of course, there's the whole Tim Schull passage, which we can talk about. Kathy ends up having the babies birthed by Sam Hamilton. They're two boys. They eventually are named Caleb and Aaron. And Adam and Lee raise them while Kathy shoots Adam and runs away to become a prostitute in Selena's proper.
Marking Adam yet again with the mark of Cain. Yep.
Yeah. And she's got a scar on her forehead just like Charles's scar. So all the evil people murdered.
And she runs. She goes so far away, it's almost 7 miles.
Right. And then stays there forever.
And stays there forever. She goes so far away. She goes to Salinas.
And then we watch the twins grow up and deal with their intergenerational trauma.
Yeah. I mean, really, it's like a crazy, like, this book is so weird. I just can't, I really hated it reading it this time, the first couple hundred pages. Then I came around. Mm-hmm. I can't help but still have deep affection for this book, and I don't know why, because even sitting here talking about the plot, it just feels strung along. Like it's like the classic, like the king died, then the queen died. There's no like, and like the only thing that makes you feel like there's any sort of meaning to the plot is this heavy-handed allegory, biblical stuff.
Right.
And I was so like rolling my eyes, but it still kind of worked mm-hmm. by the end. I don't know. Like, I still kind of feel like, wow. You know, I don't know. Where are you guys? Where do you land on this book?
Okay,
do
I
you
love
have
it.
Any?
I'm
really
complicated. I love your tortured existential monologue.
Yeah.
When I read this book, I was 19, and I loved mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. And all I remembered, honestly, was one word, and it was not Tim Schult. It was Kathy. Kathy was so
she just stood out.
Captivating.
She's a great character. She's a great character.
Yeah, and
is she or is she a horrible character? Because
she's so on the nose. She's so on the nose.
So okay. Like, so here's where I'm standing right now. After my second read, I feel like it's the least subtle book I've ever read.
Ever, ever, ever.
Right. There's no way to misinterpret
this
book, right?
Because even like the biblical allegories, the characters are saying, well, like in the Bible with Cain and Abel.
Telling you. And then half the characters become religious just so they can tell you.
You're like, are you aware, by the way, that this is very similar to a story in the Bible?
Sam Hamilton's described with a beard and long hair, and then it's like, and his daughter got him confused with God and her mom. You're like, do you think? Like, Jesus.
However, and the Kathy thing, I can't wait to like dig into this, but she's so insanely evil that I can understand why that would be a big eye roll for some people, but especially given when this came out, like, let's do it. This is like Exorcist level, but she's never exorcised.
She's completely irredeemable.
Right.
Yeah.
She's completely unmotivated.
Yeah.
Like,
no reason to do anything other than money.
And I kept thinking of like great villainous characters, you know, like Iago, right, is the one that I kept thinking of. It's like, but even he's given a motivation, isn't it? I can't remember the backstory, but there's a hint that he was somehow crossed by Othello back in the day, and like there's at least the insinuation that he's evil with a purpose. Like, but it's like literally spelled out, like she was born evil, and like the word
psychopath
is not in the part. Yeah, but that's what she is, and it's so. And like, I was completely like, ugh, this is so one-dimensional. This is awful. And then her sections are the most compelling.
Yes. Right.
Because I felt like it was, what's the Showtime show where you're watching the serial killer?
Dexter.
Like, Dexter. It's like the predecessor for Dexter when she's like just in a whorehouse, like, you know, plotting to murder people, mm-hmm. take over and get their money. I was like, well, this is thrilling. Like, this is fun to read. So it ends up being the most exciting parts of the book plot-wise.
Right.
Because it's just, but it's also just so...
It's ridiculous. But I will say, so there's two things that I was like, these facts are undeniable. One is Steinbeck is such an amazing writer. So this feels like the best writer in the world went insane. But it means that there are sentences and paragraphs. There's this one I was gonna underline it. I didn't have a pencil and I didn't need to because I just remembered it for a whole week till this episode, just talking about Adam, you know, after the war, how depressed he became. The whole sentence is, Adam reduced his personality to a minus. And I was like, that's the best thing I've ever heard. Yeah. So there's things like that everywhere. And then everywhere. Steinbeck is such an interesting person. And you can tell he's like grappling towards these like liberal ideas, but they're off or they're like weird or it's the wrong time. That's being very generous. But like there is a part where he's, you can tell he's kind of like, maybe she's getting revenge for, you know, all this sexual abuse. And then he's like, nah, she's evil. And
she's just no good.
And so like, it's there as I was reading it, as I was reading her parts and the Lee parts, and the Irish stuff, I was just like, man, a million undergrad midterm papers have been written about this book because there's a lot to deal with on a character level of like, is this as messed up as it's reading right now? Or is he like actually shining the light in like a correct to our 2021 eyes dimension? It's very strange. So that kept me captivated. But the writing is unbelievable at times, like unbelievable in both ways, like unbelievably incredible and then unbelievably ridiculous.
I had no memory of it being such a pot boiler. Like it's a total soap opera. I had no memory of that.
Oh yeah,
at all.
Yeah. And that's what keeps it going, because like, frankly, I could do without any of the Hamilton family stuff.
Yeah, I don't give a shit.
I don't care about Tom, Desi. They all blend together, and like, by the time you get that chapter where, which one is it, Tom kills himself or Will, I was like, what is, why do I care about these people?
You don't.
I don't. Like, I care about the Trasks because of the biblical stuff.
Right.
And then I care about Kathy because it's a full-on crime novel thrown in there, and there's all these lies and deceit. It's like so, soap operatic. It's wonderful.
But to your point about the beautiful lines, there was a line that I underlined, and this is in my book. It's on page 567. Her face was young, perplexed pain.
Wow.
Like, what an amazing sentence that is. Like, I've never thought to put those words together like that. Young, perplexed pain.
Okay, I got another one.
He is the best at like the two sentence character description that tells you everything you need to know about this person.
Yes.
It's like screenwriting. I actually realized now that like, oh my god, this is like a masterclass in how to introduce a character and screw it in, because he'll do it in like a paragraph. Like that section, as much as I just talk shit about the Hamiltons, in the beginning when he does like all nine Hamilton children in a cup, you're like, whoa, like each one of these could have their own novel, and he just is able to toss them off and like feel like they're completely fleshed out characters, even though you only get a sentence or two.
Yeah, it's or the story incredible. Where one of them, he's like, and then she grew up, and then there's this like whole entire amazing part where she sells war bonds and goes into an airplane. Yeah. It has nothing to do with anything, but I was just like so into it.
It's a great little line.
Another incredible line that is just so simple. This is so Steinbeckian or whatever we're going to dub it. So Aaron is like, he's been told, or like there's a bug in his ear that his mother might not be dead, as he's been lied to, but he also like,
because Rabbit told him,
but believing all of that would make everyone who's ever respected a liar. So it says Aaron felt that something had to die, his mother or his world. So then he just decided she was dead, and that's just so good. It's so good.
The thing that has always stuck with me about the book is that if you grew up in California, at least if you grew up in California in the 1970s, maybe it's not the case now, the reason all this stuff feels so familiar, Ryder, is that whenever you had a standardized test, they used something from East of Eden, like as the reading comprehension part.
You're right.
So
what?
It was, yeah, so
passages.
Every single time there was any kind of reading comprehension standardized test for anything in California in the 1970s and 80s, it was from East of Eden or Grapes of Wrath. Because there's these big, dense paragraphs, and you have to comprehend what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And what's character setting and plot all in the same paragraph. You have to, you know, comprehend that. So as I was reading it again, I was like, oh, yeah. Like, this. The reason this seems familiar to me, other than having read it before, is the feeling of utter pain and suffering of an open blue book in front of me.
Right, exactly.
But the other side of it too is there's so much California history in the second half of the book.
Yeah.
That again, like if you grew up in California, is just like it's the, in Northern California specifically, is just so much hammered into you about Salinas and Monterey and the farming and the missions and all that shit. But I gotta tell you, like the fascinating shit for me is like when they're trying to figure out how to freeze vegetables, I'm like, oh, this is actually kind of fascinating to me. Like,
that's how you know you're old.
Yeah, it's like, oh,
how did they freeze lettuce?
I actually
more information about ice.
I truly enjoyed the automobile passage, like when the guy comes out to fix the automobile, because it was so weird and like, was, you know, I'm sure as a kid I found that section boring, but it was like, right. That must have been so weird to have these machines making all this noise. And I just love like the post officer is like, ugh, these things are coming all. They're going to be all over the place. He won't have horses anymore. And I was like, oh, that's right. There used to be horses everywhere. Right. Like that must have been so. And I was reminded of like, I had this friend who's a pilot. And whenever he, whenever we hang out with him, he always brings a drone. Like, because he's like, you know, a pilot. He has like
my brother has a drone drones. That he brings around with him. Everywhere.
And like, we were in Italy. It was actually his wedding. We were in Italy for his wedding. And like, he brought out this drone and he put it, you know, down. Like, we're all having like drinks or whatever after, like, this was before the wedding. So it was just hanging out after a dinner or whatever. And he brings his drone out and I look at it. And I was so disgusted. It was like this machine. Yeah. It was like, you know, it was like seeing it's, I mean, look,
easy
it's Terminator.
To picture this
it's the Terminator drones. Like, right. That's what I was looking at. And I was like, this thing looks like this bug that's going to kill us all. And he was like so proud of it. I was so disgusted. And that's what I felt like, you know, Steinbeck was able to capture what it must have felt like to be on these rolling California hills and then have these sputtering, awful machines come in.
Well,
and like for us, it's just like part of the background noise of normal life.
But it's also sort of true about like the mechanization of farming that was happening post that period in that part of California. I wrote a little short story for an anthology that's coming out in a couple of weeks that takes place in Pajaro. Which is just, it's basically right in the same place. And I did a bunch of research for this scene that's like, you know, half a page long, about that whole area where the trains were coming through and picking up all of the fruit and vegetables that were being farmed there, and how basically when Southern Pacific came through and moved the train lines, that disrupted farming in America. And I was like, I'm learning so much from my own research. And I read East of Eden, and I was like, these poor people. But
well,
the other thing though, just says like, I forgot the potboiler part. I forgot the profound BDSM aspect of this book. I mean, listeners, I'm not even joking. There's a profound subplot about BDSM in this book.
And I'm like, let her live. Let Kathy do her thing.
And I forgot, like, also, so Kathy is just horribly evil, of course. And so this very kind whore is going to give Kathy her whorehouse. Faye is going to give Kathy her whorehouse. And on the night that Faye, like, tells her, I really appreciate the work that you do. I think you're really great at your job. I'd like you to eventually take over. What Kathy does to pay her back is torture her and poison her and make her think she's having a nightmare. Like, what the fuck was that?
Yeah, and then a very elaborate poisoning, which I appreciated.
Very elaborate.
A poisoning that...
It's enthralling. Like it's a procedural from a villain's point of view. It's like Breaking Bad. You know, you're like so like just you. It's a real page turner in the middle of a you know, and it's necessary in this book.
Yeah.
Without that, this book would be really slow.
Yeah.
But you're like really kind of like, oh my god, what's gonna happen? I can't believe she's doing that, and it just keeps going darker and darker.
Kathy's super dark, and what I remember too is that in the miniseries when I was a kid, she's played by Jane Seymour. And as she's an older character, she's racked by horrible arthritis. And this image of Jane Seymour in the miniseries with these hands that are just gnarled claws.
Fantastic.
Demon claws.
Has always stuck with me. Like, that's my fear. Like, I'm always, like I stretch my fingers. I don't get Jane Seymour's hands.
So, I think that, oh, man. So, I'm trying to think about Kathy on a feminist level, which is hard. Because I think the obvious thing to go to is that she's Eve and she's like corrupting everyone. But that is actually not where this is going biblically. Because as readers, maybe we should have spelled it out for you. Her name is spelled with a C. And I do think that this book, you know, it's got something going on with the intergenerational trauma that is the point of the book in both family threads. Like, right. The Hamiltons start happy and then shit really goes wrong for about half of them. And then the Trasks have to work so hard to just be psychologically okay. And Kathy's just a part of that line. Like, it's not Adam and Eve. It's the thesis of the book seems to be like, we are all either Cain or Abel, and that's that, and Kathy's Cain. Right. So I do think it's a mistake to put her as Eve or Lilith or...
No, I mean, part of her villainy is actually her anti-womanness, right?
Right.
Like, she's always described with, like, and like her lack of motherhood or lack of normal female characteristics. So... her like using sexuality as power, it's not like a self-empowering, feminine, sex-positive version of that.
No.
You know, but if you took the actions of Kathy, right? Like if you were to separate her from this book, like if I were to write a movie of this book, you could make that possible with the very same story, right? Like the idea that like she is sort of stuck in this man's world where she doesn't have power except through sexuality, like. But that's not the story he's telling.
No.
That is, he has villainized her from the moment he introduces her. And he's like, he just outright says, like, she is evil.
And
like,
let's be real. Like, she doesn't have a pattern. She does a little of everything. She does psychological torture. She burns houses down. She poisons people. She shoots people.
She kills her parents.
sleeps with her husband's brother.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So,
and then also, she can also sit still for hours in a catatonic state planning your demise.
Right. She bites Sam's hand.
Right. Like she literally bites his hand.
Bites the hand. Oh, my God. It's so... It's interesting. I like what you were saying, Julia, and I agree, like, with the Lee stuff, too. You know, when you get into this race, it's so hard because, like, on one hand... Steinbeck is incredibly progressive. He basically describes code switching before people really knew what that was.
Yeah,
when Lee does his pidgin English and when Samuel is able to like sort of call him out on it and say like, I can tell that you're smarter than this and that you're not as foreign as you're pretending to be. And that he can drop his accent and just be an intelligent person, and Sam is able to see him for, you know, as an American, essentially, as a human being. But then, of course, there's all this sort of essentialism and Orientalism also in the same book, where it's like, you know, this sort of wise Chinese cook who's always serving and feminized, and there's a lot of stereotyping, and it's like as much as self-conscious as Lee is about it. I don't know if the book is as self-conscious about it. And I don't know. So I don't know. I mean, on one hand, it's just kind of cool. I mean, I have to say, like, who was writing Chinese characters? You know, what white guys were writing about a character the same? So there's credit to be given to Steinbeck in some regard. And I, you know, as a kid reading it, like, I loved the Lee character. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember, you know, just loving Lee, Sam, and Adam, like that dynamic, and of course the central conversation they have about Timshel was like so, I mean, that just loomed so large in my mind. I think, you know, here I was reading a really long, big book, and encoded within it is them interpreting a very important story, right? Like it's like what you by if you like discovering the ability to interpret a big book, and within it they're interpreting a book and like finding meaning, and it all comes down to like one word and one passage, and if you can like unlock that, then you have like a secret powerful meaning,
right.
I loved that. Like that was so important to me as a kid, as a teenager, that I, you know, that I might be able to like walk away with like wisdom from a novel or from mm-hmm. the Bible or whatever. And like the fact that these three heroes, you know, if there are any heroes in the book, it's the three of them and it's their friendship. But it's also just so cheesy the way that like the good people can just sense the badness right. of Kathy. Or can they all just like the morality is so black and white and so heavy handed that it's like, I don't know. But like I said, like I can't help but have a deep affection for this book because it does.
Well, but it I think
it is and it isn't. Yeah.
I think the power of it rests on, like many books we've talked about that we read when we were younger, on when you read it. Mm-hmm. So if you read this book when you're 16, 17 years old, and the morality is literally so black and white in these situations that people are stunned when they find out the evil that someone is. So for instance, Cal takes his brother to see their mother. This is, you know, 500 pages into the book. Yeah. And Aaron is so shocked by who his mother is that he essentially decides he cannot live anymore and enlists in the army to go die in World War I rather than live with the knowledge of who his mother is. And it's like, bro, like...
Relax.
Come on. Like, that's your choice?
Yeah. So this is where I say...
But like when you're 16, 17 years old, you're like, oh my God. Like, that's what you have to do when...
Right, it's when noble. Faced, it's dramatic noble, in the right. way that you are.
Right.
It's the kind of dramatic swings. And
right, and also it's important to remember that Aaron and Caleb are like 17 years old when this is happening. And right. so it's like everything is life or death when you're 16, 17 years old. And so that makes some sense. But it also, like, everyone around them is like, well, but I understand he couldn't deal with that fate. Like, what the
fuck? Also... It's important to remember, and this is something I want to get your guys' opinion on. Like, Steinbeck himself is very self-important, and
oh, he puts himself in the book.
He's kind of, yeah. But I mean, all those chapters that are like, you know, and then, you know, then the country turned older again, and the leaves change, and it's this like such a self-important tone that it's constantly letting you know, like. Big important book
right.
with big important things happening, and I am your guide for this big important book, and I can tell you, and it's like, and he makes these proclamations, these pronouncements, you know, like, when a man is wise, he often follows his path to, you know, and it's like, what are you, you know, and half the time I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about, but I get the, like, and I feel like when I was a teenager, I just loved that, because it was so like, yes, like, guide me, oh wise author, oh, godly,
I'd be happy you to, know, writer.
Yeah.
In human affairs of danger and delicacy,
yes.
successful conclusion is sharply limited by hurry. Right. So often men trip by being in a rush. If one were properly to perform a difficult and subtle act, he should first inspect the end to be achieved, and then, once he had accepted the end as desirable, he should forget it completely and concentrate solely on the means. By this method, he would not be moved to false action by anxiety or hurry. Or fear.
Oh,
very yeah. few people learn this.
See, that was like, for me, as like a kid reading, like, I was like,
oh.
Yes. Let me worship at the altar of yeah. Steinbeck.
Underline, underline. You
know, yeah, and, like yeah, that, exactly. Like, I was like, yeah, essential truth. The rest of the
right. But like now I'm kind of just like, why do I need this? You know, I'm like, just tell me the story. Because what Steinbeck is best at is good characters, like believable three-dimensional characters that are, you know, I mean, in this book, not so much, but other Steinbeck books are, he's so good at like, I guess he's really good at paradox. Like he creates characters that are full of paradox, usually, not Kathy. Yeah. And not, you know, in this book it gets, but like most of the time. And so when he, I guess like my favorite Steinbeck book I'm realizing is Cannery Row. And I think the reason is because it's a comedy. Because he does that tone, like he does that, like when a man gets drunk and he, but it's all about like poor drunk people,
right?
You know, it's like they're like they're hobos, they're like they're just the degenerates of the Salinas Valley, you know, and like that when he applied that sort of highfalutin tone to poor people or the degenerates or the forgotten, whether that's in Of Mice and Men, The Poor Workers, Grapes of Wrath, it's like for some reason it like works in a way, it's like seems appropriate. Mm-hmm. But in this book I just kept being like, dude, you're talking about supposedly your family. Like, right. Why do I care? Like, you're talking, like, great, Selena's went through the seasonal change. Like, make me care, which he does to a certain extent, but I didn't need those chapters. Like, it's just such a weird tone. But then at the same time, it's kind of comforting and kind of fun to read, too. Yeah, and, like, fun. I don't know. Oh, is it? I mean, it was fun for you too, Julia. Like, yeah, do you remember feeling that way as a teenager? Or
back to my great writer gone crazy.
Yes,
which
I think is apt.
At his best, right? At his best, like, this is the American tone with which I personally want to write. Like, where he's saying things, sentences that are simple, but also go at a clip, but also feel meaningful. You know, like, they never feel thin, even though they can often be simple. So there's a mastery there that I think is fun. Like, it's, and I mean, I find my writer brain being like, how did he put this together? But I do agree with you that, like, as you age, we're all kind of in the same age group at this point. And I feel like I underline totally different things. So instead of underlining those parts this time, I blocked out, I would consider this a perfect piece of scenic writing. This is when Tom, one of the sons of Samuel, gets the telegram. Everyone's been like, Samuel's going to die. Samuel's going to die for like 40 pages. So we all know what's coming.
It really set him off for a good send off.
And he's been like, I'm ready to die.
Yeah.
Just say goodbye to everybody. So, like,
why don't you just go swimming with a brick?
Even though that happened, these two tiny little paragraphs, really, they made me cry. Here we go. A kid comes and delivers a telegram. Tom started to call after him, and then he leaned wearily down and picked up the telegram. He sat in the sun on the bench outside the forge, holding the telegram in his hands. And he looked at the hills and at the old house, as though to save something, before he tore open the envelope and read the inevitable four words, the person, the event, and the time. Tom slowly folded the telegram and folded it again and again until it was a square no larger than his thumb. He walked to the house, through the kitchen, through the little living room, and into his bedroom. He took his dark suit out of the clothes press and laid it over the back of a chair, and he put a white shirt and a black tie on the seat of the chair. And then he lay down on the bed and turned his face to the wall. I mean, damn.
Beautiful.
So good. Beautiful. But it also has that, like, heavy quality that you're describing. And I still like it. Like, this, I see there's more of, like, a distance between the teenage self and this self that I am now. But I'm still, like, yeah, I like an intergenerational book. I like a long book. I like a book that tells me that it's meaningful. And I want to read more of them. Like, I know there's a lot of readers out there, and I bet some of our listeners are these people who are like, give me the next intergenerational, like, 20
Thousand
characters.
Acres by Jane Smiley. Thousand Acres is, like, the perfect one. It's based on King Lear. You know what I was also thinking about while reading this is, like, compared to sort of modern-day intergenerational novels or family novels, like, this versus The Corrections, give me this.
Hell yeah.
Every single day.
Really?
Yeah. Really? Yeah, absolutely. Like, I want crazy high drama. You know, I want huge misunderstandings. I don't want wealthy people upset about small lies. You know,
yeah.
I want...
Well, that makes sense, too, because you also, you really love Dickens.
Yeah, I do.
Falls into that category, too. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. So you like a writer sort of guy, like, a really well-structured sort of, like, yeah, it's so funny, because, like, I no longer read that kind of book. Like, that's what I loved when I was younger, but, like, you know, I was thinking in comparison to somebody like Faulkner,
right?
Who does, like, big intergenerational stories, but would never tell you why what you're reading is important.
Right.
Like, that's, like, the last thing Faulkner does. Faulkner instead draws you into the person's minutia of their brain in a moment where they were considering the intergenerational trauma. And then you have to, like, work backwards and draw a family tree to figure out what the hell they're talking about.
Right.
To then realize there was incest in the past and this person's still trying to deal with it.
Right.
But he'll never say that to you. You know, whereas, like, Steinbeck, like, guides you, grabs your hand and says, come, let's look at a valley and I'll tell you what a trauma this right. family had. But, and like, that's just a completely different approach. And it's so funny because I've moved completely far away from that. And I feel like most critics have, right? Like most American criticism has embraced the idea that we should, that you don't, you show, don't tell, right? Right. To put it simply, right? But like, this is so telly. And I think it's not a coincidence that this is one of his most popular novels. This is like one of the most popular American novels. Yeah. And it's like, I understand that because it's really hard for me to remember that people don't read that often. You know, like I read a lot. And even I don't feel like I read that much compared to some people, you know, but most people, most Americans these days don't have time to read that much. They only get to read like a book a year or two books a year. And I feel like when you're being told by an author, it's like great voiceover in a movie. You know, it's like people talk about Shawshank Redemption. It's like this great movie, or, you know, even like one of my favorites, Stand By Me. And I think part of the reason is that or Forrest Gump, you're being told how to feel by a narrator. Mm-hmm. You're being told like, and this is why this scene was important. And then you get to see the scene and it's a well done scene with good acting or a good turn. But being set up or paid off by a narrator, by a storyteller, is super comforting, and it makes it feel more epic than it might otherwise feel. You know, right. it's something we kind of shit on as critics often. Like, you know, I wasn't surprised to read when I was looking this book up just before we recorded that, like, critics didn't like it at the time when it came out. Really? Oh, yeah. It was completely, you know, just, like, everyone thought it was crap. And I can see why. Well, but
Steinbeck lost his mind.
So
it does feel like a lot, though, right? Like you were saying, like, it feels like Steinbeck gave himself permission with this book. Like, he was I'm going to write the most important book I've ever written. It's going to somehow relate to me and my family and, like, where I grew up. But I'm just going to go for it.
Right.
And like, just, it's cool in that way. It's, like, it's great.
So what I don't mean to interrupt, but I'm loving what you're saying, because I feel like what we're grabbing onto here that is like out of vogue is confidence, the confidence of the writer.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Dickens had it, Twain had it, and this book is coming out of those, like, he most certainly read those people. And then it's also connecting. I love that you brought up Shawshank and Stand By Me, because of course with the Evil Kathy stuff, I'm like, oh my God, this is a connecting the dots to Stephen King, who also is that cocky in his writing and is like, yeah, totally evil, 100% evil, let's do this.
Right.
Totally.
But
he always has the mystical element or the magical element that sort of makes it okay.
Yeah, and I think those super confident, like, part of the reason we hate this too is like, this is, we all know, what do those writers have in common? They're like overprivileged, so full of themselves, mid-career white guys. They're rich, they're famous, they can
everything
do anything.
Everything they write is going to get published.
So,
yeah, everything they write
so
is going to get published.
So the confidence comes through, but also that arrogance really, really comes through too. And now it's just like, oh, wow, where's the humility? Where's the, like, you know, coming at it from a well thought through direction? Like, they're like, hell no, I'm gonna write 800 pages and you're gonna love it, and I'm gonna win a Nobel Prize and be a bestseller because I'm John Steinbeck. He's
nuts. Did he
nuts.
Get those? Did he?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
He got the Nobel?
Yes.
Oh, of course.
Yes. So I also wanted to add, thinking about other works, like the morality thing, let's go back to that, because I feel like it's easy to say, like, oh, this book is so black and white. But when I think about morality lately with writing, like, this is like most fantasy these days, and a lot of YA is grappling with morality. And this is a debate amongst my friends. Like, is Harry Potter just complete garbage, specifically for the reason that, like, you're sorted into your category and that determines your whole personality type of thing.
Right.
And like Game of Thrones and everything in the fantasy world. Like, it's just addictive to be like, what house am I? What family am I?
Totally.
But this book kind of, like, it goes there for like 400 pages, but then I really do think it's arguing against it, because Adam and Aaron suck. They're sad, annoying people who are so good that they, like, can't function. So, like, their goodness is like a yoke around their necks. It's not something to aspire to. what the aspiration in this book is even if you are marked by Cain, or you are Cain, so you're marked by God or your own original sin or whatever. I don't know. Not a theologian. I don't know.
I
who
am
does
both
the marking?
God and the Holy Ghost.
Yeah. Cain gets the mark. Cain gets a mark because he killed his
gets
brother.
Gets a mark, but how does he get it?
God just
boom. Okay. It's like a lightning bolt. Like, okay. Yeah.
Anyway, so the whole argument of the Tim Shull thou mayest thing is like, yeah, the burden's on you guys, sons and daughters of Cain. Like, you still have to be good, even though you're so fucking evil inherently. Yeah. And right. I think that right. is, like, it's kind of turning from this, like, European feudal thing to a more American thing of, like, yeah, we all suck, but we gotta live together, right?
But
right, guys?
But it's also coming. It's also coming down to personal choice. So, like, Abra, you know, loves both men, and she's a good person, but she does things that are that would generally be considered aberrant, right? Mm-hmm. So, but she's doing it by choice. You know, she's ruled by choice, so she doesn't easily fall into those categories that everyone else does. And then, by the same token, Adam, who is awfully good and all those things, has lied to his children their entire lives. So
and
it's
neglect.
Not like and neglected them and like it's, only like only after they're like 11 does he ever have a conversation with them where he's like, I'm interested in you. What did you do today? So I mean, yeah, there are these clear binaries, but it also, like you said, like the last third or so of the book also starts to, like, as the onset of modernity comes into the novel, the onset of personal choice and deciding who you want to be. So hoping for war so you make more money off of beans, like, that's not a good thing. But by the same token, you're trying to make money. So for the listeners who haven't read the book, Cal invests in beans. Just go with it. And his father has lost all of his money on his Vicacta ice. And so Cal makes a bunch of money on beans and he gives his father his profits off of the beans on Thanksgiving. And his father's like, I don't want this bean money. It's blood money off of the dead soldiers who are fighting the war that are buying the beans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So all of a sudden you get a lot of shades of gray. Like Cal's is, I mean, it's this dumb idea. Like, I'm going to give my dad this money, and that will make things better. But Cal is trying to make his father's life better. But he's doing it in a really fucked up way.
I mean, several times during this book, I was just imagining, you guys know that old experiment where they, like, took the monkeys away from their moms, and then they had to, like, cling to wire monkeys? You
yes.
guys know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
I was like, that's what this book is. It's just neglected yes. children.
Yeah.
Clinging to nothing. It's very right. very sad in that way too.
I mean, I'm going back to my high school essay on East of Eden. I've actually found it on my computer.
Are you serious?
No, but the problem is I wrote it in Word Perfect.
You have a bunch of squares?
I can only open it in a text.
Hold on a minute. Why the fuck do you still have this on your computer?
I keep everything I write, man. I keep everything I write. But I remember what it was all about. It was about fate, duty, and choice, and how the three interpretations of the word or the passage. You know, like there's the thou shalt overcome sin,
right.
thou will overcome sin. So it's fate, thou duty, and then thou mayest is choice. And that was like my whole
writer,
my whole essay.
You've
wow.
got I can't to read give this. Us the first sentence of a writer. Strong high school paper.
Yeah, I can't wait.
I'm trying. It's so hard. Unfortunately, I think it was the one I found. Okay. The title, East of Eden, is an allusion to the Bible.
Nice.
And
nice.
Well done.
Not right.
Merriam-Webster defines
I see the word
a book as.
A literary masterpiece is told. It's a retelling of the Cain and Abel story, I think. Throughout a sense of justified complexities within simple lives, the intricacy of true human emotion. What does that mean? To begin the novel, we are introduced
Rewrite
to two families, Hamilton's and the Trask's. Oh God, it's so hard because I'm like looking at all these weird symbols. and trying to like erase them.
Wow. Well, we really what I should emotions. Find is
the conclusion, yeah. because that's probably where I really drive home.
Yeah,
like,
let's get. What if Ryder's ending is just one word and it's Excelsior?
Oh my god!
Which also shows up in the book, readers. Just FYI.
Wow, I'm glad you pointed out that East of Eden is a biblical reference.
Yeah,
it's important to know. Yeah, you know,
they don't make that clear in the book.
I wonder what grade I was in. I was probably only a freshman or sophomore. I was pretty young. Oh, here, the Hebrew word timshel at the essence of the character becomes the key of this story. The essence of the character's struggle to achieve happiness, for they all strive towards achieving the understanding of Timshel, whether they are aware of it or not.
Oh,
when
so powerful.
Oh my god, yeah. So that's what I mean, it's probably just like the boilerplate essay that everybody writes.
There's nothing better than a high school essay that has the opening words for they.
Just trying to make yourself sound more sophisticated, right? There's probably an ergo thrown in there at some point. Steinbeck chooses to eschew.
As Carl Sandburg said on the back of the book, a moving, crying pageant with wilderness strengths.
I just remember there were certain words that I completely would misuse, like plethora. Or like anytime I had like the opportunity to use like my thesaurus and look up some complicated word for, you know.
I misused intrepid many. Over and over again.
Oh,
I thought
wow.
I thought it meant the opposite of what it meant. And so I would put it in essays and the teacher would always be like, this word doesn't mean what you think it means. And I'd be like, well, I know. I'm just going to use it.
My favorite teacher note would just be an underline and then a question mark. Like,
yep.
Yeah.
Julia, what's wrong with you?
Really?
That's sure. What that means.
Are you sure?
I still use that in my when I'm making notes in my students' novels or whatever. Are you sure about this line? Is this the line you want to use here? They love that. That's that UC education they're getting from me. So I think finally my big thought about East of Eden is it's a must read. You have to read it.
Wow, like, I'm surprised that's your takeaway.
Yeah, like if you don't read it, you don't understand, like where every potboiler family saga, like Dallas and Dynasty and everything on television, they all come from the same shit. Mm-hmm. Like this is the giving tree of American drama.
Well, you know what it made me want to reread more than anything was actually 100 Years of Solitude.
Oh yeah, that's another
which is like to me a sort of. In my mind right now, and I want to reread it because I'm not sure, but it's kind of a better version of a similar thing. Because in that case, I feel like the narrator is way less self-important, but no less guiding. You know, like they're still guiding you through this family history. And there's magic and mystery. Yeah. But there's a sense of like self-consciousness about the storytelling that I feel like Steinbeck really doesn't quite have.
No,
you know?
He like, believes it's all important. Yeah.
Yeah, he believes it's all like, and I think Grapes of Wrath is still his better novel for that reason, is that in that he just let it kind of speak for itself a little bit more. And then like I said, Cannery Row, I've read that book so many times and I love it. And that's where this kind of voice is used to comic effect because he's elevating these, you know, degenerates, and I just think that it's so much and it's a quick read. But I agree with you, Todd. Like, this is a must read for me. Like I feel like I totally get why people are like, this is my favorite book of all time. Like, if somebody says that to me, I'll be like, yep, great. Yeah. I totally get it. Like, because you feel like you've read all the books.
Right. And you you know feel what like, I mean? You feel like you've read the Bible also. Like, well.
Yeah. You feel like you've understood the Bible in a way. You've like walked away with like something. It just has that epic quality, mm-hmm. you know, it has that like, but like early on, I was definitely like, I was afraid that we were going to get on here and I was going to be bringing up my old Legends of the Fall reference, which is. It's a shitty movie, guys. If you think Legends of the Fall is a good movie...
It's not.
You've been fooled by epic movie making. It's about nothing. Try to understand what's happening. But like this started to feel like that for me for the first like 300 pages. Like, oh my God, just another thing happened. And it happened over here. And it's so like... This is... But by the end, it totally won me over. It's not Legends of the Fall. It's actually a good book.
And do not... If you're a high school student, this is very important. do not watch the movie and think you can bullshit your way through a paper on East of Eden. You absolutely cannot do that, listener.
Yeah, if you're here for part one of your bullshitting, you can use what we said.
Right.
And
right.
You should plagiarize Ryder only with caution.
Yeah.
Thou mayest.
If you might want to start your paper with the words "for they" and then just figure out your own thought, but for God's sake, do not assume anything in the movie version happens in the book, other than a traumatic stroke. There's that. Actually, you guys...
Which is also Legends of the Fall.
You guys have to watch the movie, though, because James Dean plays Cal as this slouching sort of love interest.
He's like totally like a mid-20th century guy in the middle early 20th century.
He wears the weird sweater, and he's just all pain and suffering and brooding.
So overrated. I'm sorry. I'm a James Dean detractor.
He's a terrible actor.
He's not terrible. He's just doing a Brando impersonation, and it's like, and it's just, it was just the rebel. And then he died. Yeah. I mean, he'd only made three movies, so he just became this like legend because he was just such a presence. Yeah. He does have a presence.
Oh yeah, he's
like,
he's easy on the eyes. That's for sure.
Yeah. He's a historical.
Such an amazing.
Yeah, he actually like he is kinetic to watch, but he is. He cannot act.
No, he never could.
Which is a problem.
I mean, Rebel Without a Cause is such a weird movie. When you watch it again, you're like, what? Like, what? Why is this classic? It's a truly strange movie. But, you know, it's just like hit that chord of like teenagers at the right time. When,
yeah.
You
know, and he also, in East of Eden, he has such a profound sexuality. Actually, that supersedes anything that you see in the movie, and that's the thing that makes it feel transgressive. Like the whorehouse stuff doesn't feel transgressive at all because it touches on none of the stuff that's in the book, but he feels transgressive, and that's the thing that makes it feel sort of dangerous. So I mean, it's worth watching for sure. I mean, and Ilya Kazan is a great director, but no real bearing on the book that we just read.
Grapes of Wrath movie is actually really good, though. Grapes of Wrath movie is great. John Ford, classic. That's, I mean, it feels dated, but it's still, like, it actually tells the same story as the book well. It's really good.
The weird thing, too, about the movie, Lee isn't in it, so that whole character is gone. I mean, none of the important stuff is in it.
Yeah,
because if it's focused on Cal and then Sam's already dead. Yeah.
It focuses on Cal and Aaron and Abra and Beans.
I feel like erasing the Chinese American character is the worst possible way you could deal with that very uncomfortable.
Right. Subject. And they don't focus on the most compelling character, the woman in this book, at all. Like she's a seriously minor character throughout this entire thing.
Racism and sexism on top of the existing racism and sexism is too much for me.
It's like it's a lasagna of fucked upness.
Literary Disco is produced and edited by Justin Alvarez for Lit Hub Radio. You can reach out to us directly on Twitter @LiteraryDisco. Happy reading, everybody. Thanks for listening.